The reason why this particular lecture is going on right now is because of this airplane here. This is an RF-84K, and it served in the U.S. Air Force in the mid-50s. We're very fortunate to have it in the museum collection. It was recently restored, and it was really restored well. We used marking blueprints from Republic to make sure all the stencils are on there. So it does appear, other than the aluminum-colored paint that's on it, it does appear exactly like it did in the mid-50s. But there were many aircraft that came before the RF-84K, and there was a progression of parasite aircraft. Before I go into that lineage of aircraft, I want to kind of define for tonight what I mean by parasite aircraft. Parasite aircraft can mean many different things. The concept of parasite aircraft has been used in many different applications, but for tonight's purposes, when I say parasite aircraft, I mean a manned aircraft that is being carried or directly coupled to another manned aircraft, and with the idea that it would become operational at some point, or the progression of an experiment would lead to an operational aircraft. So that leaves out some other aircraft that are carried by another or test vehicles and things like that. Also, since I don't plan on giving a 3 or 4 hour lecture, I'm not going to cover every single one in the history of aviation, but I want to cover the important ones and focus, obviously, on the U.S. Air Force. So with that said, this is the first example of a parasite aircraft by that definition, and it's a Felixstowe flying boat and a Bristol Scout. And the idea of this and the other aircraft that I'm going to talk about, the key idea is to extend range and for various reasons and for various missions. In this case, it was late 1916, and the British had to fear for Zeppelin raids. And near the area where this was attempted to make operational use, there were Zeppelins that were coming near the coast, but they weren't coming close enough for manned fighters to attack them. So the idea was to put this tiny little fighter on this flying boat, and then when a Zeppelin came, the tiny aircraft would have the range to attack the Zeppelins. However, it was only tried once, and there really isn't very much information about this particular experiment. But we do know that it was done, and the one time it was done, it was successful, but it wasn't used to attack a Zeppelin. It was just simply a separation test. A few years later, this is a slightly different concept. The British had concerns about the vulnerability of dirigibles, and they certainly were vulnerable to manned aircraft. So the idea was that the dirigibles would carry their own defense. And in this case, they did experiment with a dirigible carrying a Sopwith Camel. It was not used operationally, but it was tested. And there were separations where they dropped the camels successfully. And the British weren't the only ones who were doing this. The Germans were doing it as well right towards the end of the war. But as far as we know, these were not used operationally, but the idea was that they would be, but the war ended before them. Now, the British also did experiments with carrying parasite aircraft underneath dirigibles in about 1925, 1926. But by then, they had realized that dirigibles as a bombing platform was a dead-end technology. Dirigibles were way too vulnerable to be flying over military targets. So by the mid-20s, although they did experiment with it, it didn't go anywhere because the dirigible as a bombing platform was going nowhere. However, in the U.S., we see the first example of a successful hookup. And that's important because if you're trying to extend the range of an aircraft and it's carried underneath a platform to a target or to an area and it drops off, if it can't hook back up to the platform, then it's got to fly all the way back on its own. So that's additional fuel. That means that's potential range that is lost. If the parasite aircraft can be dropped near the target and then the parasite aircraft could fly to the target and back to the carrier, that means that that range is going to be extended. So that's a really important thing. And the first airship hookup took place in December of 1923, and that red arrow is pointing to a Sperry Messenger. And this is a picture of that event. Now, the Sperry Messenger was not designed as a parasite aircraft. In about 1919 or so, Billy Mitchell said to a designer by the name of Verville, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, said, design a motorcycle of the sky, an airplane that can be used like a motorcycle. And Verville designed this Barry Messenger. And in about 1922, this idea of, well, let's try hooking it up underneath a dirigible to extend its range and let's see if that'll work. And the idea was to use this hook mechanism, which you can see with the red arrow. And the hook, the way that it works is it's mounted just in front of the aircraft's center of gravity. And literally, it hung by the hook. So if the pilot could get that hook onto a trapeze bar, the airplane would hang on its own by gravity. This technology really didn't go anywhere because the Messenger wasn't going anywhere. Neither was the dirigible. The Air Service started getting rid of their Messengers. There were about 50 that were built. Started getting rid of them in 1926. By 27, they were all gone. So that didn't go anywhere, but that's a key step in the progress of parasite aircraft. The Navy saw what the Air Service had done and thought it was a pretty good idea. So in the early 1930s, they designed two dirigibles with the design including aircraft, parasite aircraft. And so specifically designed into the dirigible that it would carry parasite aircraft. It was the Macon and the Akron. And on the bottom right there, you see it's a Vought biplane. And they experimented with this Vought biplane. And you can see, or maybe it might be difficult to see, it does have a hook, much like the Messenger. And on the upper right of the photo, right there, is the trapeze bar. And so, again, like the Messenger, the idea is to get this hook onto the trapeze bar. The hook is mounted just forward of the center of gravity, so, again, the airplane would hang. Now, in this experiment, the trapeze is fixed. The airplane is not meant to go inside the dirigible. On the upper, in the upper photo, you see one of the dirigibles over New York City, and on the bottom left, you can see the hook mechanism on the aircraft that was actually carried on the Macon and the Akron operationally, and that's the Sparrowhawk. And the Sparrowhawk, the ones that were carried on the Macon and the Akron were modifications of a previous design, but they were built to be carried in the Macon and in the Akron. On the upper left, you see one of the aircraft are actually inside one of the dirigibles. It would be pulled up, and then there was a mechanism to pull it out of the opening. So they could carry, each one of those could carry four aircraft inside and one aircraft slung below. On the bottom right photo, you can see the opening for the aircraft to be let down. Now, the mission for these aircraft on the Macon and the Akron weren't like previous parasite aircraft. The mission was to extend the eyes of the dirigibles. And that's a difference between how the Navy was using these dirigibles and how the British had used them in World War I and in the early 20s. These airships were not meant to be bombing platforms. They were meant to be eyes out away from the coast to see enemy fleets coming in. So these Sparrowhawks were not made to defend the dirigible. They were made to extend the reconnaissance range of the dirigible. Well, both of these dirigibles ended up crashing, one in 1933 and one in 1935. There were other dirigible accidents in the 30s, some that were a little bit more famous. And so the dirigible was really going out. Not only was it not really effective or useful as a bombing platform because of its vulnerability, but it was a problem just to fly it. And the Navy did look at possibly building more of these aircraft-carrying dirigibles in the late 30s, but before they built them, World War II came, and they had other problems to deal with. So nothing ever came about beyond that. Interestingly, the Soviets had some really wild parasite aircraft designs. The first time I saw these, I was just absolutely astounded. It looks like aircraft models, surely. They couldn't have done this, really. But, of course, they did. These are actual photos. They started by carrying aircraft on top of the wings, and you can see in the upper right there. And then they eventually got to where they could carry five aircraft. But what's really important about what the Soviets were doing is in the bottom photo, that aircraft right there. It's on a trapeze, and the Soviets were the first, in 1935, they were the first to have an airplane hook back up to another airplane. That's important because dirigibles are on the way out. that's a dead-end technology, at least as far as the military purposes that have been used before. So aircraft, hooking up to aircraft were the way to go with parasite aircraft. Now, on the aircraft on top of the wings, there was a sort of a catching mechanism, but it didn't work. So now this particular program was moving along fairly well up until about 1937. And like what seemed to happen to so many Soviet aviation pioneers, well, the guys who were doing this got in the way of Stalin, and they kind of disappeared. So that slowed the program down just a little bit. But they did continue. Other engineers did continue the program. So there was one mission in World War II in the summer of 1941 where one of these combinations flew and struck a bridge in Romania. And that's another thing that's different about what the Soviets were doing. They carried these aircraft not only to defend the bombers, but also for these fighters to be bombers themselves. It was a way to extend the striking range of these bombers. Now, they couldn't carry nearly the weapons load that the bombers could. They only carried 250-pound bombs. But still, here's a new use to parasite aircraft. Now, in World War II, surprisingly, there, within the terms that I outlined at the beginning, there really weren't many parasite aircraft developed, surprisingly. I had expected to find a little bit more. I've been reading about aircraft ever since I could read. And I kind of thought, well, if I winnow through the files and I really dig, I'll find more underneath the definition that I had said before. And a manned aircraft carrying another manned aircraft to be used operationally and to extend range. And there really wasn't much. In addition to the aircraft you're looking in front of you, the only other one really was the Fieseler F-103, which is a manned V-1, that they looked at possibly carrying them underneath German HE-111 bombers and using them possibly for suicide attack, and that really didn't go anywhere. There were other situations where you had you had these aircraft that were essentially flying bombs being sort of carried by other aircraft, but that doesn't really fit the definition because those are carrying weapons. But this is one that does fit the definition, this Japanese Oka, and we're really very fortunate to have this airframe here. The one that we have is a training version of the operational version. And this operational version of this would be carried underneath a Betty bomber, which was the standard Japanese Navy bomber during World War II, would be carried near the target, and this Oka would be dropped. And the Oka had about a 2,500-pound warhead and three rockets that after the aircraft was dropped, the rockets would fire and the suicide pilot would dive into a target, usually a ship. And this fits the criteria because it did extend the range of the Oka bomb, and it was manned. The rocket didn't have very much fuel, but it could go very, very fast and was virtually impossible to intercept once it left the Betty bomber and the rockets were lit. Many of these were destroyed while they were still hooked up to the Betty bombers because obviously the Betty bombers couldn't go nearly as fast as our fighters. Like I said, our airframe here is a trainer, and it differs from the operational aircraft by having a skid and flaps. It did not have a warhead, and it carried water ballast in place of the warhead and in place of the rocket engines. So it is amazing that we have that airframe. Now, I want to make a brief mention, just because I think it's that important to mention it, of some of the post-war test carriers. This does not fit the criteria that I had outlined in the beginning, but I think it's important for all of us to know that there were manned aircraft dropped from other manned aircraft after the war, and it was very important, but not for operational reasons. Maybe the most famous is the use of the X-1 under the B-29, X-1 being the first aircraft to exceed the speed of sound in level flight, and with Chuck Yeager at the controls. This is the X-1A, a little bit later version of that. In addition to this program, there were several programs that used the concept of a mothership and dropping the aircraft, like the X-15. Of course, we have an X-15 in the collection. More recently, the X-43. So I think it's important just to point that out, that as a test vehicle, the mothership and dropping an aircraft is very important, but not operational. The aircraft pictured here is the XF-85 Goblin, and there were two of these built. It is a really, really unusual airplane, but important in the progress of parasite aircraft. We have one of those two built here at the museum, and this aircraft really begins in about 1941 with the idea of the B-36. This aircraft is wedded to the B-36, but ironically was never carried underneath or inside the B-36. The B-36, the idea for it was developed in 1941 because it appeared as if Britain may not make it through the war. And how would we, if we went to war against Germany, how would we possibly strike Germany? We would need an airplane that could fly 10,000 miles to fly from the mainland U.S. to Germany and back, literally an intercontinental bomber. And at the time, that was a wild idea that was far beyond the technology at the time. But pretty quickly, within a year of this concept, people started asking, well, okay, if we build this bomber, and we're seeing that manned bombers without fighter escort aren't surviving very well, how is it going to survive? So military thinkers started to think about a way to get an escort that far. And the idea that kind of rose to the surface is this idea of carrying its own defense, carrying a parasite fighter. Now, the B-36 was designed with two bomb bays. So one bomb bay would ideally hold its parasite fighter, and then the other bomb bay would hold the bombs. So in 1944, the aviation industry rushed to take up this challenge. All of McDonnell took the contract, and no other aircraft company would even try to do it because it was such a challenge. The idea was that the aircraft would be completely contained within the bomb bay of the B-36 and then would be released and yet would still have high enough performance to be able to defend the bomber. It was virtually an impossible task. In 1946, McDonnell put together this mock-up for authorities to take a look at. And you can see the similarities with the final product, but there were some substantial differences. The prototype had no winglets, like you see on our XF-85 now, and it had an X-tail, which basically, if you look at the back end, the tail was like that, with no additional aerodynamic surfaces. It was only 16 feet long. It had a clearance of just a couple of inches on either side, front and back of the B-36 bomb bay. The B-36 bomb bay was only a few inches longer than 16 feet. It was only 6.5 feet high because the bomb bay right up above was the main wing spar box. So it had to be very, very short, and it was only 4.5 feet wide. Can you imagine 4.5 feet wide, an aircraft, and it just barely fit inside the bomb bay? The wings folded up, and when they folded out, it gave it a wingspan of about 21 feet. But this is where it gets really dicey. It was so small that the regulation stipulated the pilot could be no taller than 5'8", which is exactly how tall I am, and couldn't weigh over 200 pounds, including flight gear. So there were some serious restrictions. Now, the requirement that the entire aircraft fit within the bomb bay of the B-36 is one of the serious problems that eventually led to the XF-85's demise. The reason why the authorities wanted to have it fit entirely within the bomb bay of the B-36 was for aerodynamic reasons. Obviously, something hanging underneath the aircraft would cause some serious drag and would shorten the range of the B-36. Now, this problem of parasites causing the range of the carrying aircraft to be lessened, keep that idea in mind because there was going to be another solution a little bit later that was tried to offset that. So this is the cockpit of the XF-85. What you see is not much of an instrument panel. That's the instrument panel. Right there is a rudder pedal, and right there is the other rudder pedal. So the pilot had to stick their legs in between the instrument panel. What isn't shown in this photograph is there were a few instruments on the frame of the canopy. So it was extremely tight in that aircraft. However, there was a real positive advantage to carrying the aircraft inside the B-36. Eventually, B-36s would be able to fly several thousand miles, and their missions could last as long as 40 or over a little over 40 hours. So if the pilot was hanging underneath the aircraft, they would sit in this incredibly cramped cockpit for hours and hours and hours. But by pulling the aircraft inside, the pilot could get out of the cockpit. The B-36 actually has bunks, could go lay down, rest, until they get to a threat area, and then he could get back inside the cockpit. So that really makes a difference, and it really does go beyond just the pilot getting rest. It's not a question of laziness or not being able to take it. It's just is very demanding to be in that confined space for that long. It's going to affect the how well the pilot performs in combat. So, again, that would be a factor in future parasite aircraft also. Again, we have a hook. In this case, the hook is dropped down. There's a hinge right there, and when it's hung, the hinge is back. And then to release the XF-85, the hinge was just moved forward and the aircraft dropped down. So as the XF-85 is being developed, there's this idea that, you know, this is what the future is going to be. Now, it's very difficult, I think, for us now to realize that air refueling in the late 40s was not a proven science. It's so common now. But in the late 40s, these jet aircraft are coming online, and they don't have the range of propeller-driven aircraft. And there's this paradox, this difficult paradox. A propeller-driven aircraft, like, say, the P-82 or F-82, had very long range. It could go very far and escort bombers to targets far away. But then when it gets there, if it faces enemy jet fighters, it's going to be almost useless. And our aircraft that are jet fighters that would be able to compete with these enemy fighters don't have the range to get there. In the end, the solution is air refueling. But recall that in the late 40s, it's not proven technology. So designers and military authorities are really desperately trying to figure out a way to solve this paradox. I came across this cover on Popular Mechanics, and it looks somewhat fanciful, but who knows? At the time, that really could have been what the future was going to bring. Well, there was an unfortunate accident early in the program. This is the museum's aircraft, and they were concerned about the aerodynamics of such a short fuselage, that there were going to be real problems with control. Even before the first wind tunnel test, you can already see that there's another vertical in between the two on the top that has been put. There's another vertical, you can't see it, underneath. And this wouldn't be the end of the aerodynamic fixes. The winglets are yet to be added to the wing. So they hooked it up on this enormous wind tunnel, and someone didn't do the attachment right, and it dropped 40 feet straight down to the floor. And it's a little difficult to see in the photograph, but this bottom area is crushed. So the aircraft here was to be the one that would start the testing, but since this accident happened, the other aircraft that was built did most of the tests. And that drop happened in early 1948. The XF-85 did not have conventional landing gear. It was never meant to take off from the ground. It did not have wheels. All it had was a landing skid on the bottom of the center line of the fuselage, and that was really for emergency purposes. So with this configuration, it demanded that the aircraft be loaded onto the B-36, and then the B-36 would take off with it. They custom designed this loading pit to test the aircraft. Now, the B-36s were really just starting to be built, and so there were none available to be used for these experiments, so they used a B-29 instead. But the trapeze was essentially the same as what was planned to go onto the B-36. And here's the other aircraft being loaded. Now, the reason why this trapeze is so far down underneath the B-29 is the problem of turbulence so close to the fuselage of the B-29, and that would be a problem. And you'll find that turbulence and vortices were huge problems with all the parasite aircraft. when you have a large aircraft moving through space, through the air around it becomes very turbulent. And when you have a smaller aircraft nearby, the aircraft will porpoise, and there's all kinds of control problems. So this is one of the early tests of the B-29 with the XF-85. By the way, the airplane that was used for the test was nicknamed Monstro, which some of you might recognize from Disney's Pinocchio. That was the whale. But here's the first test, and on the first attempt, the pilot, who was a very, very experienced pilot for McDonnell, he had come up, and it's a little difficult to see in this photograph, but the hook is actually in front of the crossbar. And he tried to catch it, and instead the aircraft lifted up, and his canopy hit the crossbar. It broke the canopy. It knocked his helmet off and his oxygen mask off, and he dropped about 2,000 feet before he recovered. You can see the aircraft pitch up here, and in this photo, there's no canopy. It's been broken, and he's diving down. He did recover. He was not injured, and he did land on the skid, but this would continue to be a problem. Again, in this photo, you can see there aren't winglets on it, but part of the problem was the design of the trapeze. It made the turbulence even worse. But this small aircraft, with really not a whole lot of control surfaces, and with it being so stubby, when the pilot got near the B-29, it would start doing this. And then he had to apply just the right amount of throttle to hook on. If he went too fast, it would hit, and the nose would lift right up and smack the front part of the trapeze. So needless to say, it was not only difficult, it was very, very dangerous. There were several attempts. There were 7 free flights and 10 captured flights. Captured flights, they would extend it on the trapeze and then bring it back up. But of the 7 free flights, the pilot only managed to hook up 3 times. Now, if a test pilot has these kind of problems, how could they possibly expect an operational pilot to not only be able to do this, but to do it when he's tired, maybe do it with a battle-damaged aircraft, maybe do it when he's wounded, and it was clearly kind of a dead end. Also, it only carried enough fuel to fly in combat for maybe 20 or 30 minutes, and in the time that the aircraft was coming back to hook up, the carrying aircraft would be vulnerable. So all these problems together made the decision to cancel the program a pretty easy one. And by the end of 1949, the program was canceled. But this wouldn't be the end of trapeze parasite aircraft. But we're going to go in a little bit different direction, because about the same time, there was another technology that was being developed for parasite aircraft that had absolutely nothing to do with trapezes or hanging the aircraft underneath. And it starts with a German scientist by the name of Vogt in World War II, and he was in Germany, and he came up with this idea that if there were the wingtips on aircraft were articulated, they could carry fuel, and it would extend the range of the aircraft. And what I mean by articulated is there's a joint right there, and there's a joint right there. And another scientist in Germany thought, well, I wonder if it would be possible to hook up aircraft to each other. And they did experiment with 2 light aircraft that were tied together with a rope, and then they were brought wingtip to wingtip. There isn't very much information about this program because the German Air Ministry wasn't that interested in it. But it was done, but it didn't go anywhere. But from this idea, Dr. Vogt came to the United States under the paperclip program, along with another German scientist, and they proposed an idea of hooking aircraft wingtip to wingtip. And this photo shows the earliest experiments in what is called wingtip coupling. And I tell you, this photo is in our archive here. And when I first saw this photo, I couldn't believe it. It doesn't look real. It really is amazing. And those of you that understand the forces of aerodynamics and 2 airplanes and what happens on the ends of wingtips, tremendous amount of turbulence that comes off the end of a wing. And the bigger the airplane is, the more turbulence there is. So this, to me, is just absolutely remarkable, and it seems almost harebrained to me to even try to do it. But the first experiments were with a C-47 and a Q-14, and they were done right out of Wright Field. So this is somewhere over the fields of around Dayton. And one of the pilots that was involved in this program is Bud Anderson, which I'm sure many of you recognize the name. And he could very well be flying this Q-14 right here. The way that the system worked, it was really kind of unusual. There was a spike that faced backward off the wingtip. And on the C-47 was a ring. And the Q-14 pilot would get that spike that's pointed backwards in front of that ring and then just ease off on the throttle. And that spike would go into the ring, and then the drag of the PQ of the Q-14 would hold it in that ring. And then if he wanted to decouple, he could just advance the throttle and it would come right out. And amazingly, it worked really very well. The first time that they did it, they bent the ring and they had to decouple. And they extended that ring out about a foot and a half or so to get a little bit further out of the wing vortice. And it worked very, very well. And in fact, there were 231 couplings. Some of them were done at night. And it's interesting because Bud Anderson said that after a while, the coupled flight seemed easy. It was pretty much routine. And they deliberately picked the Q-14 and the C-47 because scaling those out, that would be roughly equivalent to a B-29 and an F-84, which was a concurrent goal. So this is really the start of coupling with the idea of using four-engine bombers and using jet fighters. And that led into Project Tiptoe. And here's a picture of two F-84s coupled with a B-29. Now, there's a huge difference between a C-47 and a Q-14 and a B-29 and an F-84. And there would be serious consequences in those differences. The way this system worked was more complicated, but a bit stronger. On the left, you see that would be the wingtip of the F-84. This spike that's right here would be facing forward, not backwards. And this is what would be on the end of the B-29. There's this cup, and the cup was on a piston that extended out. The F-84 pilot would put this spike into this cup, and it would be drawn in. And when it was fully drawn in, there was a clamp here that clamped onto the back of the F-84's wingtip and would hold it there. But there were some serious problems with the B-29 and with the F-84. First of all, there was a lot more control with the Q-14 as far as advancing the throttle. With a propeller-driven aircraft would respond much quicker than a jet. There's a little bit of a delay compared to the propeller-driven aircraft. The first test they had was in the summer of 1950, and there were several successful couplings. And there was a handful of pilots that were trained to do this procedure, and they did learn how to do it. But the B-29 wing was much more flexible than the C-47. And sometimes if they didn't control the F-84s on the wingtip, it made the wing of the B-29 move, and they would have to decouple as quickly as they could, fearing that they would rip the wing of the B-29 off. They didn't do it in turbulent conditions. It was only when the wind was calm, which if that was to be done operationally, that would really limit when the missions could be performed. And also another problem was they tried to manually control the aircraft. They ideally wanted to have some kind of automatic control because when the airplane was on the wing, it had this tendency, they called it flapping. If this is the wing and here's the F-84, it wanted to do this. And the wingtip would go up and down, and it would create these oscillations which threatened to take the wing of the B-29 off and tear everything apart. So the pilots really had to pay attention, had to control their aircraft. So it was really dangerous. But still, they did manage to do 43 successful couplings. In the process, they were developing an automatic mechanism that once they coupled with the aircraft, with the B-29, they could set this automatic mechanism. And, today it probably wouldn't be that big of a deal with computerized controls and things like that. But back then, the pilots that were involved with this program, they didn't really trust it. And the first time that they did it, the first time they tried to do it, the pilot had hooked up, and he flipped the automatic control on just for a moment. just for a moment. And the wingtip came right up, and it went right over. It bent the wing of the B-29, and the F-84 came down on the wing, upside down to the B-29. It took the wing of the B-29 off. Everybody was killed. So that was the end of that. Still, in spite of that accident, there was another program which went one step further. And it would be RF-84Fs being carried on the wingtips of B-36s. Now imagine, starting out with a Q-14 and a C-47, think of the speeds, think of the size. Every step they're going up, there's a larger aircraft. They're faster aircraft. So, but it was considered to be an important project. Again, is air refueling really going to be the way that we're going to be able to extend the range of aircraft? So with this next program is called TomTom. And on the bottom left, you see there's quite a different mechanism. On the wingtip of the F-84 were these grabbing jaws. And they would come up, and you see how this extends out? There's a good reason for that. The further out they get, the less turbulent the vortices would be. But still, it's a B-36, for gosh sakes. There's enormous vortices coming off the end of that airplane. But still, this was an important program, so they pressed on with it. But these jaws would grab onto the end of this boom, and then the RF-84F would be drawn into the wingtip of the B-36. And there were about 10 hookups that were successful. But my gosh, the pilots were bouncing all over the place trying to get next to the wingtips of these B-36s. So what ended this program was that a pilot hooked up to the wingtip of the B-36, and even though he was hooked up, the vortices that were coming off the end of that wing was making his airplane go up and down, up and down, up and down. And on one of those cycles, he went up and took 6 feet off the end of that B-36's wing. And nobody was injured, and both aircraft were recovered successfully, but that was it. Okay, enough. So, but meanwhile, while this was going on, now, one thing I found amazing as I was doing research into this is that this is a relatively short period of time. We're talking from the late 40s pretty much to the mid-50s. All this is going on at the same time. It's so compressed and so many programs going on. Well, while this Tiptoe and TomTom were going on and the XF-85 had failed, about a year after it failed, this project FICON was started for fighter conveyance, or sometimes called fighter conveyor. And it built on the lessons from the XF-85 and improved upon those. And it really is remarkable that it was turned into a workable system. And pictured here is is an F-84, and it's the very first time that this new system was used. It's quite a bit different from the trapeze that the XF-85 used. First of all, the trapeze for the XF-85 caused an awful lot of turbulence. And as you can see, this boom system is much more streamlined. It's not going to cause the same amount of turbulence. And also, there are two basic hookups. On the bottom left there, there's a hook on the front of this F-84, and the pilot gets that hook on there, and then the boom comes down, and in the back, there are two attachment points on the back, right back here, and those attach onto the aircraft, and then it's drawn up. And it really is brilliant, the way that they figured out the problem of the forces. In the XF-85, when it would hit that trapeze, there were tremendous forces, and there wasn't a good shock absorption for that. Even 2 or 3 miles an hour can make a huge impact. It's very difficult for a pilot to get up so close to a large aircraft and be able to attach up to that with only a half a mile or 1 mile per hour difference. I mean, imagine. Well, the way that they had a buffering system was right here is a hydraulic ram, almost like a huge shock absorber like on your car. And then when it hit that, this would take the shock, and then it was drawn up to the B-36. Well, it turned out to work pretty good. B-36 still did have some turbulence underneath, and it still wasn't easy, but it was possible. And in the first part of 1952, they started doing these hookups, and there were nearly 200 successful hookups. So finally, it looks like something is going to work. The next step was to use a faster aircraft, and this airplane was used as the prototype for the RF-84F. And they converted it to the wire RF-84F by putting this hook, and it may be a little bit difficult to see, but right there is a lug, and that's one of the lugs that the back end of the boom would grab onto. We are very, very fortunate, and there you can see it's hooking up. We are very fortunate to have that aircraft in the collection, and it's over in our R&D hangar. And I have to say, I've been at the museum for over 9 years now, and it just is amazing to me that here this aircraft, I don't know how many times I've walked by it, and I see it, and I think, well, that's really neat, really historic aircraft. We're fortunate to have it. But if you pick one aircraft out of the 250 aircraft that are here, each one of them has really a rich history and an important place. Even though we have so many, it's easy to maybe not appreciate each individual one, but this is an important airplane in the progression of Parasite aircraft. The next step was to get it operational, and it looked like it was going to work. So an order was placed for 25 RF-84Ks. And essentially, an RF-84K is a modified RF-84F, which was the best tactical reconnaissance fighter that the Air Force had at the time. The only real changes to the aircraft were, right here you see what's called an anhedral. It means it's down, canted downwards. On the normal RF-84F, it was straight out. The reason why it was canted down was to fit better into the bomb bay of the B-36 that would be carrying it. And the other change was the nose hook, which in here you don't see because it's retracted. They developed a retractable hook. So those are the major changes. The aircraft did go operational, amazingly. The squadron that flew it was the 91st SRS there out in Washington. And there was a B-36 unit, the 99th Strategic Reconnaissance Wing, that was in a Air Force base nearby. And they went operational. They were activated in late 1954, but they went operational with the RF-84Ks in about the summer of 1956. And the mission profile was not that they would be hooked up underneath the aircraft on the ground, but that they would take off and hook up on the B-36. And here, there was a way that they could load it on the ground. And I included this picture primarily to show you the boom close up. They would not normally load them on the ground. Here's the hook right here. You can see that piston. And then right there is a lug, and on the other side is a lug as well. So you can see the boom system is much more streamlined than that large trapeze that was used with the XF-85. But this is a picture of an RF-84K with this operational unit. It was a SAC unit, as you can see by the SAC stripe that's right there. And here's an operational aircraft approaching and hooking up. Now, this is just before the back lugs get engaged and it gets drawn up. Now, it wasn't drawn completely into the aircraft, but this gives you some idea. The top portion of the RF-84K was drawn up into the B-36 bomb bay. Now, again, as I mentioned before with the XF-85, this is a really effective system to keep the pilot from getting fatigued, because the pilot could get out, get a walk-around oxygen bottle, and go into the pressurized area of the B-36 and go and lay down for hours. He could eat. He could go to the bathroom. Now, with the tip concept, even had that worked, imagine having to sit off the end and have the airplane going like this for hours and hours and hours. So this was a much better system than the tiptoeing. And this was an idea of what their mission would have been had we gone to war. On the right is Spokane, Washington. They could also have been deployed to Loring Air Force Base out in Maine. And the blue that you see would be the range of the B-36. And then the B-36 would let go of the RF-84K, and it could go this far and back to the B-36. Right there is Moscow. So this concept put Moscow in range of the continental United States. Another way to do it would be to fly from Loring down to the coast of North Africa and then release the RF-84K, and again, it could hit Moscow. So it was a workable system. It was complicated, it was difficult, but it was workable. Now, most of the publications that talk about the RF-84K, they emphasize its reconnaissance capabilities. And it, for the time, it had very good reconnaissance capabilities. But there are allusions that it could have also been used as a nuclear carrier. And I suspect that not much is written about that because at the time, I'm sure it was classified. And so there isn't much in the publications, but there's a hint to it. And certainly at the time, there were nuclear weapons that it could have carried. So that's another possibility, too, as a nuclear strike aircraft. So here we are. It seems to be the heyday. It works. The system works. It's in operation. So it looks like this could be the way to go. And so much so that we had to – it was really great. We have this pamphlet in our archive that I came across that talked about these great possibilities for the future. Just imagine a Parasite F-105. Wouldn't that be great? They actually were thinking about that. And a Parasite F-102, and then the ultimate, Parasite aircraft that had a radius of 1,000 nautical miles and could go Mach 2. So there were people that were thinking that this is the way we were going to go. Even better, how about this concept? Have a Parasite aircraft underneath, which you can see right there, that B-36 is holding it. It has just dropped this one with two aircraft, one on each wingtip. Just imagine. So this is what some people were thinking would be the wave of the future. But FICON ended, and it ended for several reasons. First of all, air refueling. It was proven. There were B-50s that were doing air refueling. There were KC-97s that were doing air refueling. Air refueling was used in combat as early as about 1952 in Korea. The first one was a group of RF-80s that tanked up, and then there were F-84s that tanked up using both the drogue and using the boom system. So it was proven. Another thing was that the B-36 was about to be phased out. It was just starting. I think by about 1959, the B-36s had been phased out in favor of the B-52. So it would be very difficult to keep a squadron or two of B-36s operational. It would be very expensive if those are the only ones that were flying. And lastly, in terms of reconnaissance, the U-2 was coming on board about 1956, and there really wasn't a need to have this high-speed tactical fighter being used for reconnaissance when we could use the U-2. It could get the pictures by flying high, not by flying fast. So those things combined ended FICON just at the point, really, where it had become truly successful. The unit that flew the RF-84K flew operationally for a little over a year, and then their aircraft were eventually turned over to the Air National Guard. Several went to the Michigan Air National Guard, and they were flown simply as other RF-84Fs because they were essentially the same. They just took the FICON gear off of them. But the concept of Parasite aircraft is not over because we have it today. And here's Spaceship One and White Knight. Now, I would admit that this is, I don't know if you'd want to call this operational or not, but this combination won a recent space competition. So I don't think we've seen the end of Parasite aircraft, but for military purposes, I don't see a future in Parasite aircraft today.